I had pastors in the area tell me that there was no way that we would ever be able to function on the approach that we were taking when we first started. I mean, they said it wouldn't work. They said, you will never get anyone to teach a Sunday school class. Only intimidation works with that. And the other big thing was, you're not going to pass an offering plate? That ain't going to work. But here we are. And what a neat family. My word, my word. We are, we're going to stay with Romans again this morning. And next week, of course, is Easter. We'll do some Easter things next week. But I can't pull out of Rome. I like what Paul is doing so much. And we're going to stay with it. There was a movie that came out, well, now a long time ago, more than a decade ago. Told a story of, it's called Babe. Have you seen Babe? Some of you remember it. Maybe you show it to your kids now. Told the story of a pig who'd learned to herd sheep, like a sheepdog. And every so often throughout that movie, there's a new scene was coming on, they would show it, they would introduce it because down in the corner of the screen, there was a group of little mice that would pop up, and then in just this really, really cute little mousy voices, they'd say, "The way things are," or something like that. I mean, they did it better, but their little phrase was "the way things are." And then the scene would go on to reveal some inalterable truth or fact of life on the farm. If you got a copy of the notes for this morning, if you've got them in your hand and you look at the title, you know that I've called what we do this morning, this lesson, free will and the way things are. Funny thing about free will, because God has given every one of us the ability to make very real choices that have a profound and oftentimes eternal effect on both our own lives and on the lives of others, we can sometimes mistakenly begin to feel as though our free will has the power to alter the way things are. And sometimes it can, and then sometimes it can't. And knowing the difference between the two is literally the key to success in life. Now, hopefully that's going to make more sense to you by the time I finish this morning. We're going to return to our study of the book of Romans, and we will spend our time during the next few minutes laying a foundation for our entrance into the 10th chapter of the book of Romans. As we move back into our study, it'll help you to remember that Paul wrote the three chapters we're in, chapters 9, 10, and 11, to explain the nature of God's relationship with the nation of Israel in light of the establishment of the church, which at first glance may seem miles away from what's been going on in your life during the past week. But given the fact that through Christ, God has extended to every human being, both Jew and non-Jew alike, the invitation to enter into a father-child union with himself solely on the basis of our believing he's telling us the truth when he tells us that Christ paid our debt for our sin on the cross. Just choosing to believe him. I mean, how has that affected his relationship with Israel? All of a sudden, through Christ, God opened a way for every human being to have direct, personal, eternal access to him. Before we finish these three chapters, we will see Paul offering us some fascinating information, specifically about God's relationship with Israel in the light of his establishing the church. But there are some other things going on in these three chapters as well, things that have far greater significance than just within God's relationship to Israel. It is in these three chapters that Paul takes two of the most difficult concepts He ever addresses the sovereignty of God and the free will of man, and he sets them side by side. Years ago, I shared with you a joke that one of my Trinidadian friends told me when I was living on the island in 1970. I want to share it with you again because I think it illustrates really well why we so often have such trouble with some of the statements that we find in passages like the ones that we're studying in these three chapters, chapters 9, 10, and 11. My friend came up, big grin on his face. Of course, see, I was the missionary. I was the God man. So he had a soda bottle in his hand, and he came running up. He said, "Larry, God is everywhere, isn't he?" I said, "Yes, God is everywhere." He said, "Is he in this bottle?" I said, "Yeah, he's in the bottle." And then he went, "Got him." That's just that, by the way, is classic Trinidadian humor. That was. He was just really pleased. Okay, and you wonder, what in the world has that got to do with the book of Romans? Well, see, I think there is something inside every one of us that wants to do exactly that same thing with God mentally. We want to be able to contain him, to figure him out in a way that answers all of our questions in a way that allows us to feel mentally comfortable with him. We want him bottled. I'm packaged in a container that doesn't offend our finite reasoning and logic. But when we get to Romans chapters 9, 10, and 11, the cork flies out of the bottle and actually the bottle disintegrates forever. Partway through our study of Romans chapter 9 last week, we heard Paul make these comments. "Who are you, O man, who answers back to God? The thing molded will not say to the molder, 'Why did you make me like this?' will it? Or does not the potter have the right over the clay to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use?" And in clear, powerful language, we heard Paul tell us that when God established free will in his creation, he did not at the same time in any way forfeit or limit his ability, his right to sovereignly intervene in the affairs of his creation, in the affairs of man. Free will, our free will, is in no way an illusion, some kind of divine game God is playing with us, but neither is it what we human beings so often like to pretend it is, the ability to establish for ourselves some kind of alternate creation in which God does not exist, proclaiming to ourselves and to our world that morality and truth are purely private matters, matters that can be determined by each individual for his own chosen approach to life. In the words of the little mice, our free will does not change the way things are. The mental games that we so often play with ourselves as human beings are really quite remarkable. I've heard folks say things like, "Well, you know, I really don't believe God exists," or, "Well, you know, I know that's what God has said, but I don't really believe that's true." And when they say things like that, there's a part of their mind that feels as though because they have said it and because they really believe it, it has therefore become truth. The free will given to us by our God truly does give us absolute ability to accept and believe anything we choose to believe. But it does not in any way alter the reality of who God is, nor does it change the structure that he's established for us as his creation. Now, it may seem like I'm getting a little bit off track here, I know, but I find this whole area so fascinating. You see, logically, as created beings, the only sensible, reasonable thing we could ever do in our relationship with the God who created us is to discover, to the best of our ability, who he is, what kind of structure He's created for us, and then, well, then order our lives in patterns consistent with Him and with the structure that He's given us. And that discovery process would logically have to begin with, well, whatever clear revelations of Himself that our Creator has chosen to give us. Revelation, well, a revelation such as His own appearance on this earth in human form. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh, dwelt among us. And we beheld His glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. But our human logic runs into problems with this because we know it will involve our using that remarkable free will of ours to then choose to submit to that God who's there. And when it comes right down to it, most of the world just simply isn't going to go there. They're not going to do it. So we got to come up with an alternative. So what most people do is to create for themselves a mental concept of God that then allows them to feel more comfortable in their choice to exclude Him from their thinking. There are some powerful illustrations throughout Scripture about this whole process. One of my favorites is that parable that Jesus told about the talents. You find it, it's in Matthew chapter 25, beginning with verse 14. See, the Lord describes a man going on a journey. Before he leaves, he gives one of his slaves 5 talents of gold, and another 2, and then a third 1. After a while, he returns and he finds that the first 2 have taken what he entrusted into their care, and they've done well with it. They've made good profit with it. But it's the comments of the third slave that gives, as he gives an account of his stewardship, that just it fascinates me. See, this is what he says. He says, "Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. And I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground." See, here it is. You have what's yours. Okay, now obviously the parable is used by Jesus to describe our relationship with God. And this last slave says, "I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed." Okay, now where in the world did that slave come up with that concept of his master? The only thing that slave had ever received from his master was kindness and generosity. This was the same master who dropped a talent of gold into his hands and allowed him to do with it anything that he chose to do. Of course, when we take this parable and we plug it into our relationship with our Creator, the slave's concept of his master, not even remotely close description of God Himself. When John described the God who really is, he said simply, "For of His fullness we have all received, and grace upon grace." But then, where'd that slave come up with his twisted concept of his master? Well, obviously, he created it in his own mind. And he did so because it freed him from having to mess up his life with the thought of any kind of responsibility or accountability to this master of his. And those are typical games that we human beings play. How often have we heard someone say, "Well, you know, if God would do this or do that or allow this or allow that, then He is certainly no God that I want to have anything to do with." And with a skillful little bit of mental sleight of hand, we then create for ourselves a God that we're more comfortable excluding from our thinking. Okay, now my point is simply this. True free will is not the ability to create for ourselves the God we want. It is the ability to choose for ourselves how we will respond to the God who really is. Okay, now as we're studying Romans chapter 9 last week, we heard Paul telling us in that chapter that God created all that is, reserves for himself the absolute right to do whatever he chooses with whatever he's created. That's not where Paul stops this discussion. In fact, there's a phrase in the last verse of that ninth chapter that forms the heart of Paul's message to us in all three of these chapters, 9, 10, and 11. It's a phrase so important that Paul repeats it word for word 11 verses later. It's actually a quotation from the prophet Isaiah, talking about this Creator God who can do whatever he chooses with whatever he's created. Isaiah says, "Just as it is written, behold, I lay in Zion a stone of stumbling, a rock of offense." And then he says this, "And he who believes in him will not be disappointed." It is that phrase, "And he who believes in him will not be disappointed," that Paul uses as the springboard to move us from this discussion about the sovereignty of God into his comments about the power of our free will to shape our destiny. He wants it clearly understood that we cannot change who God is. In his own self-portrait, God said simply, "I am who I am." But we can change how we choose to relate to him. And that, my friends, is the heart, the central core of the free will given to us by our Creator. Every day we live, in fact, countless times throughout each day, every one of us chooses for ourselves how we will relate to the God who is. Those are the choices that determine everything else in our lives. And with that in mind, I want us to look again and to look closely at that one phrase given to us by Paul as our introduction into this whole discussion about free will. "And he who believes in him will not be disappointed." You know what I see happening there? This is our God saying to us, "I've given you the right, the ability to decide how you will respond to me. You can pretend I'm not here. You can pretend I don't exist. You can try to use me for your own ends. You can try to control, manipulate me through religious games. You can decide you know yourself and your needs better than I do and reject all that I've said to you. You can worship other gods more to your liking. Gods that you can control. Gods who require no submission, no trust, no obedience. And here is the choice I put before you this day. Behold, I lay in Zion a stone of stumbling, a rock of offense, and that stone is me, myself. And at first you're going to be offended by it. You'll look at it, you'll look at me, and you'll decide that my intrusion into your life is altogether offensive. It will mess up all of your goals, all of your well-ordered priorities, all of the things that you're clinging to that you believe you absolutely have to have in order to be happy. But hear me, my creation. Hear now the promise that I make to you. I, your God, the only one you have, the only one who is, I say to you now, he who believes in me will not be disappointed. Yes, he is the potter. Yes, he can shape you as he has shaped you because it's his choice. And yes, there are times when every one of us will shake our little clay fist at him and cry out, "Why did you make me like this?" But his offer to each of us is clear. when we stop shaking our fist, when we allow ourselves to settle down on the potter's wheel, and most of all, and this is the really hard part, when we choose to believe in Him, to trust His hands, His shaping, His molding in our lives, we will find Him telling us things that we could never have heard before. We will hear Him revealing to us why He has made us as He has, why He has molded us in the fashion He has chosen. And in those conversations and in those discoveries, we'll also begin to understand for the first time our purpose, our place in His world. Free will does not give us the ability to change the way things are. It simply gives us the absolute freedom to choose for ourselves whether we'll live in harmony with the way things are, with the way He is, or whether we will fight against them. And the beginning of the correct use of all free will is found in that one statement. And he who believes in Him will not be disappointed. He who believes in Him, he who believes in what He has said, he who believes in His love and His forgiveness and His endless grace and His compassion, he who believes in Him and in that belief chooses to run to Him rather than from Him, will not be disappointed. Now, Paul is just, this is just the introduction to what he says about free will. But we'll move into it actually 2 weeks from now when we get back into our Romans study. Let's close in prayer, shall we? Father, thank you for your love that is far beyond our arrogance, our stubbornness, our blindness, our determination to hide from you. Thank you for your love that finds a way to reach out to each of us, allowing us to see who you really are. Thank you for being absolutely good. Thank you for your determination to use that goodness to fight for our redemption, our healing, our growth, and our fulfillment. We love you, Lord. We pray in Christ's name.